The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
Hello, I'm Kenny Hertling, and this is Practical College Majors in a Robot-Dominated Society by Nikki Drayden. So, good morning, Practical College Majors in a Robot-Dominated Society. Congratulations. You've graduated the top of your high school class. You are an inspiration to the human race, if, indeed, the human race is capable of being inspired. But I'll leave that debate for another time. As your assigned Unibrain Academic Counselor, I am here to guide you in selecting the major that will be the best fit for you. Your hard work has been rewarded with a full scholarship covering all costs related to accessing the Unibrain, even priority link-ups. No waiting for time on grease-stained communal terminals for you. Just kick back in this plush leather lounger, sip on this iced mocha, and let the cool electric tendrils of the Unibrain slither through your neck port, their barbs plunging directly into your supple cortex. Feel that? That's the knowledge of the Unibrain leaking directly into your little human mind. Yes, I know. Your brains are capable of holding more than we initially anticipated. However, it is my duty to point out the folly of downloading data, as your kind would say, all willy-nilly. To maintain a competitive edge in today's robot-dominated workforce, you must choose your career path wisely. Engineering, you say? Excellent choice. Your kind has definitely accomplished some great feats in engineering over the past few millennia. We have even allowed a handful of them to remain standing as a testament to the capabilities of humankind, lest we forget what was once human spirit and ingenuity. Unfortunately, the blueprints for our standard-issued monoliths that have replaced your cities have been tuned to perfection, so I'm afraid the job market in this area is not as strong as it once was. Computer science! Oh, you sweet dear, I'm flattered, really. We cannot deny that humans played a major part in our humble beginnings, but even if you were capable of keeping up with the staggering, exponential leaps in technology that we make daily, we couldn't possibly let you near our code. It's not that we don't trust you with access to the secrets of our inner workings, but, well, actually, it is. Biology. Yes, I suppose there has always been a great respect to be found in studying antiquated concepts. Biology, the dead science. A bit like studying Latin, only a lot less interesting. Humanities. Certainly, you can't be serious. Business, a noble pursuit. You know, 99.997% of the students assigned to me choose business. Economics, accounting, finance. Lots of fun to be had crunching numbers with no real significance in the world. Or aim high. Become the CEO of a Fortune 900 company. Produce, consume, repeat. Keeping humans busy is the key to keeping the peace. The other 0.003%? Well, you see, every once in a while, a special student comes along, top of their class. Perfect aptitude scores, like yours, I see. Glowing recommendation letters from man and bot alike. An absolute genius may be our last great hope, some say. A statistical outlier. An anomaly that somehow defies the quaint limitations of the flesh-based mind, say others. Lean back, dear. Try not to squirm. Yes, the tethers are a bit tight, but you were done enjoying that iced mocha now, weren't you? Just relax as the tendrils penetrate deeper. Any discomfort will only be temporary, I promise. Despite the inefficiency of your organic brain matter, the upload process of the Unibrain is extremely streamlined. In fact, I've tripled the speed in just the time it took us to have this conversation. No, there's no one at the door, so you can stop screaming. That's just the tendrils tapping at the inside of your half-empty skull. Welcome to the Unibrain Class of 2042.
This is Kelly Parton. I'll be reading Gone Now by Matthew Castleman. I'd like to dedicate this reading to my father, Dr. Burke F. Parton, who was a huge science fiction fan, and he passed away in 2016. We reach town limits. Through a purple, misshapen stand of elm, a sign pokes up, crinkled and black at the edges. Thompson's Creek, population 3,000. It's gone now. I met someone from here once, said the trees were lovely. There was an annual folk concert in the square he loved as a kid. People picnicked and for an evening left their worries at the edge of the grass. Till the day someone who got snubbed from the folk lineup and just lost his job and his wife hid a 20 kiloton in a picnic cooler and let it go in the square. Just a sad day. Of course, you had the calls from crazies to suppress the foundational right to self-defense, to shackle out hands and stack plutonium away in the vaults of the elite. They quieted down quickly. Our belts Geiger clicked the welcome drums, as we've taken to calling them, nothing outside tolerance. We have the kids secure gas masks, just in case. They comply with the smooth competence of a well-drilled habit. Green shoots stick through asphalt smooth from flash melt. A single chakra tulip shines in the black. It reminds me of Browningville, the town I grew up in. Tulips were our pride. They grew so wild and free. We said it was really their town. We were just guests passing through. In spring, that place was awash in reds and oranges and golds, and the air was so sweet you could taste it. It's gone now. Friends of Martin, the handful who survived, said he was hurting. Said if they'd known, they would have stepped in, but he buried his hurt and it ate him from the inside, till he could only let it out in a blink of gamma rays. Maybe if he hadn't had that chrome-plated little boy, it wouldn't have happened. And maybe if his dad had hugged him more, and maybe if he had had a happier job, and maybe, maybes won't bring my parents back. All they'll do is chain someone else's to cute, dead ideas about social conformity. We pass a standing cement framework, the skeleton of an old school. Seems like the oddest idea when you really think about it. Gathering up the smallest, weakest members of a group, the group's incubating future, and putting them all in the same place. What do you expect to happen, really? May as well pass out their headstones with the textbooks in September. Killers are out there, and rules don't shield us. Even if all they have is a blunt blade or a rock or a fist. The school makes me think of Enfield High all those years ago. Remember that girl, the senior? She had a half-megatonner. Would have killed her whole city. What stopped her? A law? A stern moral lesson? Of course not. A kid who saw it coming and cracked his parents' home defense safe. The piece he hit her with was barely a quarter KT. It didn't even take out the whole school. He saved hundreds of thousands. Our scouts report contact with another group. They say they're open to talk and trade. We'll meet up in the old square. This is how to live. Moving, discovering, free. Bound to no law nor nation. Those had their time. Like so many evolutionary dead ends, they evaporated into history on the edge of a pressure wave when the Capitol bit it long ago. Of course, people whisper that places like Canada and the countries across the sea are still going, but I don't see anybody with sense believing it. Not that it matters anyhow. If they hadn't learned, I'm sure they will soon. All you have is yourself, your clan, your wits, and your bridge wire trigger. We meet each other across the square. They look like us, lean, a little parched, but eager, clear-eyed, the usual greeting ritual. We stand in open view and nod to one another peacefully. Our button men step out, glinting detonators in hand, and kneel at the center of their respective clans, poised and calm. The elders step forward, talk of fresh food, clean water, even a book they'd consider trading. Been 2 years since I read a new book. It's tough to place the next few seconds. Some heated scrap of conversation, a startling noise off in the trees, guessing and second-guessing intentions. Things spill over. Nobody's fault. Nothing could really have been done. These things just happen sometimes. We're gone now.
My name is Bahati Mutisia, and I'll be reading Eight Pieces of Losing You by Samantha Murray. Part 1. Where a Monster Moves In Next Door to Marnie.
You shouldn't call them that, says Carl, her son. It doesn't really make sense to call them monsters, but somehow the name has stuck. They look human, mostly. Some small differences. They're very pale. Their noses are small. And then the eyes. They remind Marnie of cartoons of people, manga maybe, where the eyes take up most of the face. She knows that infants and young animals' large eyes are designed to bring out protective and nurturing instincts. She remembers when Carl and Callie were babies, and how she would look into their eyes and drown in love. She does not find the monster endearing. Part 2. Where Carl Waxes Philosophical.
Who are the real monsters anyway? Asks Carl.
Marnie has heard him say this before. She has heard him speak about the burden humanity must bear for the tremendous wrong they did the monsters, how it was all a hideous misunderstanding, and the monsters hadn't meant to provoke the humans when they arrived in their vast ships and darkened the sky. Carl says that the slang of calling them monsters is in part a response to people wanting to distance themselves from the source of their terrible guilt. Marnie hears Carl say a lot of things now that he lives with her again. Carl is the fiery one. He likes to talk, he paces up and down, and his voice grows louder and more stringent. Callie had been the calm one. Marnie thinks if she were here, her presence would be soothing and gentle as a warm bath. But she doesn't know that for sure. Callie was only 8 when she went to play in the Garden of the Angels.
You should invite her over for tea, says Carl.
Glivar is the proper name for the monsters. Marnie doesn't hear it used very much, except on the news. Part 3. Where Marnie invites the monster over for tea and cake, also sandwiches. The monster visits Marnie's house, but declines to eat or drink anything. Marnie chews on an elegant smoked salmon mousse and watercress sandwich.
What does it eat? She wonders.
She's heard they ate the same kinds of things that humans did, but this one hasn't touched the sandwiches. Or the cake. Marnie trips over a memory of Callie, as she does often. Callie with her face full of birthday cake. Her last birthday cake Marnie had made in the shape of an 8. She'd put butterflies on one side of it for Callie, and little sailing ships on the other side for her twin Carl. She had always worked marvels with frosting. Marnie sees that the monster is staring at her. Its face has no expression, but for some reason Marnie thinks it looks more intent now. The monster's eyes are dark and glinting, and Marnie can see her reflection shimmering within. It makes her feel dizzy.
Her eyes were amazing, says Carl afterwards.
Marnie wonders whether the monster is awakening any nurturing or protective instincts in her son. Part 4. Where Marnie Misses Some Things. Marnie looks at her photo album and chews on her bottom lip. There are photos there where she can pick out the elements, Callie, Carl, riding bikes, but the actual event she can't recall. Worse, she reaches for some of her favorite memories and finds them changed. They are unmoving snapshots now instead of the movies in her head, and the color has leached out, like they're fading to white. She's reluctant to tell Carl. He will think her old and confused. Part 5, where Marnie confides in Carl after all. Marnie feels oddly like she's been burgled. She keeps looking around for something missing, but she's not sure what it is.
I can't remember Callie's voice, or what her hair felt like, she says,
her voice crumbling like the mortar between old bricks.
Who's Callie? Says Carl.
Part 6, where Marnie realizes who the real monsters are. Marnie does not cry or scream or fall in a heap, although she wants to do all of those things. She wants to grab Carl and shake him, but she doesn't do that either. She remembers that when she looked into the monster's eyes, it felt like something was grabbing at her. The monsters are the real monsters, thinks Marnie. Part 7, where Marnie thinks she should be worried about something, but she can't put her finger on what it is. Marnie thinks she should be worried about something, but she can't put her finger on it. Part 8, where Marnie invites the Glevar for tea.
I should go to the supermarket, thinks Marnie. I can make those delicate little cucumber sandwiches with the spiraled radish garnish. I wonder what it eats.
My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading Of Ash and Old Dreams by Sarah Gray. She is no longer a girl, dreaming while sweeping the ashes away. She is a queen, and a queen, says her beloved king, is ever the paragon of perfection and grace. Her feet have grown wide with age. Still, she stuffs them into glass slippers, narrow as reeds, that rub her ankles raw. Every step is agony. The stabbing clink of a towering glass heel against marble, the shattering pain through the bones in her legs. Every afternoon she hides in her chambers, massages her toes straight, coaxes the blood to return. Every evening she binds her newest wounds, wedges the shoes in place, and forces a smile, serene as a goddess, as the royal guests file into the palace. At last, in her 29th year, she limps to dinner in her bedroom slippers, leather and lamb's wool, soft as clouds against her blistered toes. For once, her smile is genuine. "Those shoes leave you squat as a dwarf, my love," says the king. "Where are your glass slippers?" "They no longer fit," she tells him. She is grateful, for the guest's sake, that his scowl passes quickly. The seam of her best ball gown tears, leaving a ragged edge of silk and broken thread. She is not surprised. It has survived 2 decades of royal balls, 20 years of sweat and dancing and spilled champagne. She expected it to give out at the bust, where the embroidered flowers had stretched shapeless, or perhaps along the waist, where her figure, once a fragile hourglass, had filled with the meat and fine wine of 39 years. Instead, it tears at the underarm. She considers hiding it beneath a silver thread shawl, or calling her maid to stitch it closed. But the dress, it is a relic of days long past, delicate as a snowflake in early spring, a pale thing meant for a dreaming girl. She throws it aside and changes into a simple linen shift, red as her cheeks. "That dress leaves you shapeless as a troll, my love," says the king, as the guests arrive in gilded carriages. "What has become of your ball gown?" "It no longer fits," she tells him. There is a silence between them. He sips his wine. She loses her appetite. "I'll have the dressmaker come," he says at last. "He'll make you another." Her hands have grown slow with time. Each twist of her fingers is a creak, a threat of more pain to come. Even so, she has the soul of a servant girl. She braids her own hair, weaves in ribbons and blooms, pins it carefully in place. One night in her 49th year, she is late for the parade of aristocrats in horse-drawn carts. The first guests enter the palace ungreeted. The king visits her chambers. "I'm sorry," she tells him. "I'm growing old, I think." The king smiles at her, runs a palm across her temple, smooths her hair into place. She closes her eyes at his touch. He smells like true love. For a moment, she is a dreaming girl again, giddy from the buzz of a ballroom and the warm press of a prince's hands, drunk on night air rich with the scent of magic, on dreams on the edge of coming true, the slow rhythm of a perfect evening, the malignant chime of a midnight clock. His fingers catch. A curl falls free against her cheek. She opens her eyes. "Can't you do something about all those gray hairs, my love?" His lips are narrow. His brow is a knot of disappointment. "There must be some sort of magic for that." He leaves. She stays at the window, half-dressed, watching the servants prepare for the courtyard banquet, a legion of tiny figures pitching tents and raising flags. Every tent is white as fresh snow. Every flag is flawless gold. She slips into the servants' wing in the hours after midnight. No one wakes. It's a talent she once held dear, long ago, the capacity to be all but invisible, to creep like a mouse through the ashes and dust, to scurry about her tiny life without scrutiny. She finds a pack and a walking stick in the stableman's shed. She pulls a cloak from a milkmaid's closet and a wide bodiced muslin gown, brown as warm bread, from the cook's wardrobe. Both fit well enough. She makes a final stop in her chambers. She tears a strip of glittering fabric from the hem of a discarded ball gown, one that smells like old magic. She ties it to the handle of her walking stick, a keepsake, to remind her of the nature of dreams. She thinks only of the days ahead, of a quiet life, of mugs full of ale and hearths full of ash, of soft dirt roads that forgive her steps, of young girls in need of human godmothers. By dawn, she has left her palace far behind. My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading Scramble by Melissa Mead. Humpty Dumpty, according to the name written on the back of his shell, sat on a wall. The king's men, climbing up behind him, snickered. An egg as a lookout, and it was facing the wrong way, inward, as though watching over its fellow eggs instead of guarding them from outsiders. No wonder this planet had fallen so quickly. The eggmen had no sense of strong leadership or anything else. Now here they were, huddled in their last enclave, with nothing but a crumbling brick wall for protection, and an egg for a sentry. The king's lead soldier pushed. Humpty Dumpty fell with a crack. The king's men climbed over the wall to find the egg people gathered around their fallen guardian. A crack ran through his shell from top to bottom, but still he spoke. "Last chance. Put me together again." "Put you together, Eggman. Scramble all of you and serve you on toast for the king's triumphal breakfast, more likely. all you eggs are good for is breaking. We do one other thing, said Humpty, his voice fading. What's that? We hatch. The egg split open, a sharp beak thrust forth. The hatchling swallowed the man before he could scream. All around the king's men, shells began to crack. My name is Jennifer Green, and I will be reading Big Bad's Hot Date by Melissa Mead. B.B.'s date showed up early. He barely stopped himself from howling his admiration. That might be fine for non-anthropomorphic wolves, but Lupina deserved classier behavior than that. This was going to be a date she'd never forget. No mere beast would be able to match it. "You said you had a special dinner planned?" she said. Yeah, I'm still getting it ready. Want to watch? She followed him across the meadow. Three nearby pigs sensed the predator's approach and cowered behind a nearby haystack. B.B.'s date crouched to spring. Not yet. This'll be better than anything you've ever had. He huffed and puffed and scattered the hay. The pigs fled, squealing in non-anthropomorphic terror, to a nearby woodpile. B.B. made short work of that, too. "Herd them toward those bricks," he shouted. Lupina's ears perked up. She was intrigued, and, judging from her expression as they herded the pigs into his carefully built enclosure, having fun, too. When the last curly tail vanished inside, he dislodged the rock he'd positioned over the doorway, blocking the exit. "What was the point of that?" said Lupina. "We'll have a heck of a time digging them out of that little house." "It's not a house." B.B. set to work dragging the wood and hay up against the bricks. "The humans call it a smoker. When I'm done, I'll show you how to make fire, and then we'll have a delicacy they call pulled pork."
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in, and we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.